Passenger ended in a brawling melee early today, with passengers throwing chairs, oars, and life jackets at police. Three policemen and several passengers were hurt. One youth was arrested. It wasn't clear what caused the outbreak. Some passengers complained that the time of the cruise had been shortened and that the boat was overcrowded. It was carrying 2,400 passengers and a crew of 26. The captain said that when the boat docked near Battery Park in New York City, people were throwing so many chairs overboard that it was impossible for the crewmen to get their lines out. He said the crew had to go to the pilot house for protection. It took 100 policemen to restore order, representative of its state. Charles Quinn, NBC News, Washington.
Listen again on the hour when State Farm brings you NBC Monitor News.
The San Francisco Story, brought to you by Jenkel Davidson Optical Company, serving all of Northern California. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bud Heide, inviting you to be the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for another half hour of the stories of San Francisco, the story-making towns and hills that surround it, and the people who made San Francisco's past so colorful. These impressions, written by Samuel Dixon, are brought to you each Sunday morning at this time by Jenkel Davidson, stylists in eyewear with offices throughout Northern California. We hope you enjoy today's story. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. But what is the substance of light? Well, the Greeks had a theory for it. In fact, they had two. Modern scientists have confirmed both. Light is both wave-like and particle-like in nature and springs from electromagnetic radiation. Without this luminous energy, no object would be visible. But when too much light concentrates and hits certain surfaces, it reflects and turns to glare, bombarding the eyes with up to 10 times the light they really need in order to see. The result can be painful. Today, however, harsh glare can be virtually eliminated with sunglasses containing absorptive lenses, plain or prescription. These restful lenses let in only that amount of light your eyes can comfortably use. Do your eyes a favor. See these scientifically correct lenses in a frame to suit your fancy at all Jenkel Davidson offices throughout Northern California. Bank credit cards honored. This is the second chapter in our story of John Charles Fremont, first United States Senator from California. And to refresh your memory, we remind you that last Sunday's episode concluded when Fremont started on his third expedition to the West with the blessing of his devoted and spirited wife, Jessie. He started on this third expedition carrying with him a howitzer cannon, which he had obtained from Colonel Stephen Watts Kearney, commandant of the Jefferson Barracks near St. Louis. His goal was Sutter's Fort in Sacramento, and the expedition would take a year. And Jessie Benton Fremont kissed her husband goodbye and Godspeed and sat back to await the passing of that year. But less than 2 weeks of the year had passed when a letter arrived addressed to Lieutenant John C. Fremont, and Jessie opened it and read, "Sir, you are herewith ordered to turn over your expedition to your second in command and to repair at once to Washington. An explanation is required of why you have taken a 12-pound howitzer cannon on a peaceful scientific survey. Signed, Colonel J.J. Apex." Well, Jessie Fremont sat stunned, the letter in her hand, and her heart turned to stone. This expedition was to be John Fremont's great adventure. Nothing must interfere with it. But she knew that a duplicate of the order would have been dispatched by Colonel Apex to Fremont and camped at Cause Landing. And if that duplicate reached him, he would have no choice but to obey. He was intensely patriotic and a good soldier, so that duplicate order must not reach him. Jessie Fremont was a wise, clear-thinking woman, not prone to act on impulse. But here was a situation that would permit no procrastination. A member of the Fremont expedition, a trapper, had remained behind in St. Louis to be with his sick wife. And Jessie Fremont sent for him ordered him to ride with all speed to Cause Landing and place in the hands of John Fremont the message she would give him. And an hour later, the trapper rode out of St. Louis. And a couple of days later, he had placed in Fremont's hands the message from his wife that read, "My dearest, do not delay another day. Trust me and start at once." Another 48 hours passed, and another trapper came riding into St. Louis with a message from John Fremont to his wife. Just five words. "Goodbye. I trust and go." And so it was that Fremont left Cause Landing on his western journey before the duplicate order calling him back to Washington had arrived. But the drama of the howitzer cannon had only begun. Jessie Fremont wrote to Colonel Ebert, telling him what she had done and giving her reasons. And the next day, Colonel Kearney called on her, and again she told her story. But Kearney, a friend of the family, turned on her in cold rage. The United States was on the verge of war with Mexico and England. An American Army officer was traveling with a cannon into disputed territory. Even if he was ignorant of the message recalling him to Washington, that act constituted mutiny. The following day, Jessie told her father, Senator Benton, what she had done. He ridiculed Hebert's order, ridiculed Kearney's indignation, ridiculed everything that would interfere with the vitally important expedition. But when his daughter said, "What will they do to John when he returns?" the answer was brief and blood-chilling. Court-martial and dismissal from the service. And all unaware of the brewing storm, John Fremont and his train were pressing on into the West. Six months passed. Jessie had not heard a word from her husband. And then rumors began to circulate. The expedition had been lost in the snows. John Fremont was dead. No man could live through the perils of a winter in the Rockies. 8 months, no word. 9, 10 months. And then friends became solicitous. Conversations would stop abruptly when Jessie entered the room. People looked at her sadly, kindly. She was so young, so lovely, so brave, and so stubborn. There was no hope of her ever seeing her husband again. But Jessie Benton Fremont went about her daily duties, chin up, confidence in her heart, her eyes flashing. The year ended, the 12 months that had been allotted for the expedition, and now the waiting was taking its toll. She was not sleeping. She had lost weight. She weighed only 90 pounds. Her features were gaunt, her cheeks hollow, her eyes huge, sunken in her fleshless face. But at dawn on the morning of August 7th in 1844, 14 months after he had ridden out of Cause Landing, Jessie heard the rush of his steps on the stairs, and she was in his arms. Fremont was thin as a rail, a stubble of beard on his gray, fatigue-chiseled face. He was nervous, restless. The snows and malnutrition had taken a terrible toll. But word of his arrival spread as though bells proclaiming the news had been rung throughout the city. He was the returned hero. Friends, politicians, soldiers thronged the house, and only when they were alone did he tell his wife of the perils and triumphs of the journey. The expedition had traveled from the Mississippi to the Dalles in Oregon, and then traveling south to a point east of the Rockies, then across the Rockies, and then an undertaking that men said was impossible. John Fremont had been the first man to cross the Sierra in winter, to cross them through a pass he discovered, the Oregon Trail. And down the west slope of the Sierra went the brave company to find haven at Captain Sutter's fort in Sacramento. And out of that grueling passage of the Sierra was born in the brain of Fremont the conviction that when war came with Mexico, the United States could cross the Sierra through the pass he had discovered and take California. 6 months passed, during which Fremont prepared his official report of the expedition, and then new orders came. He was again to cross the land, this time to protect California against capture by the British. And so in August of 1845, the new expedition started out. And in December, he once more rode into Sutter's Fort. From Sacramento, he traveled southward to the most prosperous town in California, Monterey. And there he met with outright opposition. The Mexican officials resented the intrusion of an expedition from the United States, and Fremont was ordered to leave. But he answered the order by encamping north of Monterey in the Salinas Valley, entrenched in a fort with the flag of the United States flying above it, a direct challenge to Mexico. The challenge was not accepted, and Fremont returned to Sacramento. But in May of 1846, 9 months after he had left the Mississippi, the first shots of the war were fired, and Fremont was on the march. And that march was to encompass a page of historical drama often told and only to be given a line at this time. He marched into the Napa Valley and led the Bear Flag Revolt at Sonoma. And then fickle destiny played her trump card, and her instrument was the howitzer cannon. Captain Kearny had never forgiven Fremont for the embarrassment that had been caused him, and now Kearny, as Brigadier General, marched into California, and his arrival precipitated a contest between him and Commodore Stockton for control of California as a territory of the United States. Stockton was in control. Kearny demanded control. But Stockton was on the ground first, and he named John Fremont the first civil governor of California. Kearny demanded that Fremont recognize him as commander-in-chief of California, but Fremont refused. Kearny countermanded Fremont's order, rescinding his authority as civil governor. But Fremont stood his ground. Kearny then ordered him stripped of his rank, but Fremont, ignoring the army officer, stood by the Navy commander, Stockton. And in Washington, as the endless months dragged on, Jesse Benton Fremont awaited the return of her husband. We'll get back to our story in a moment. People tend to associate forgetfulness with a certain age, beginning about 40. But if there is a coincidence between 40 and forgetfulness, perhaps it's because by that age, a person has more to remember in past experience and in present responsibility. Small wonder that small matters sometimes get overlooked, like, what did I do with my glasses? More people do start asking that question about 40 because that's the age when the daily strains on our vision begin to catch up with us. That's why you shouldn't forget to see your medical eye doctor every 18 months or so at any age, but especially past 40. And if you have trouble keeping track of your glasses, maybe you should have a practical second pair of prescription sunglasses. They're doubly useful in the sun and as a spare standby. Jenkel Davidson Optical Company, serving you throughout Northern California. Bank credit cards honored. Now, back to our story. John Fremont came home to Washington, a bitter, a physically wasted shadow of a man. Despair in his heart. Despair reflected in his hollow eyes. He stood before his wife and told her that his career was ended. He had returned to Washington to face charges brought by Brigadier General Kearny, charges of mutiny. And the Washington that had lionized John Charles Fremont now gathered for his court-martial. Sides were taken. The majority sympathized with Fremont's insistence that Commodore Stockton was the actual commander-in-chief of California, but sympathy was not enough. Fremont wore the army uniform of the United States. His superior army officer had given orders that he had refused to accept, and that constituted mutiny. Weeks and months of preparation for the court-martial dragged through the red tape of official Washington, until on November 2nd in 1847, Fremont and 13 officers sat in solemn meeting to hear his court-martial. He faced three charges: disobedience of the lawful commands of a superior officer, conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline, and mutiny. At the end of 3 months, the court found him guilty on all three charges and ordered him dismissed from the service. Appeals were carried to President Polk, and he found the court justified on the first two counts, but not on the charge of mutiny, and he therefore ordered Fremont freed from arrest and ordered to report for duty. It was as simple as that. But not to John Fremont. He did not believe himself guilty of disobedience of lawful commands. He did not consider his conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline. He only found himself guilty on the charge waived by the president, that of mutiny. The favor of the president meant nothing to him. He was handed his sword and told to report for duty, and he said, "Thank you, gentlemen," and resigned from the army. At the age of 34, having crowded a lifetime of drama into a short few years, he was prepared to assume the life of an everyday civilian, learn to know the devoted wife with whom he had spent so short a time, raise a family, and probably ride an omnibus to his office each morning with a portfolio of topographical maps under his arm. An ordinary citizen, a civilian. But it took more than bitterness to kill the dreams of an adventuring visionary. There had always been the dream of someday building a railroad across the Rockies and the Sierra, spanning the Atlantic and the Pacific. And now Senator Benton and his associates came forward with just such a plan, a railroad from St. Louis to the Pacific. Of course, the way had to be mapped, surveyed, and obviously the man to do the work was John Charles Fremont. This time he'd go to California on his greatest adventure, and more, he'd take his wife and his daughter with him. He'd make a home for them in California. More than that, another baby was expected, and this one was sure to be a son. Yes, with his wife and son and daughter, John Fremont would create an empire in California. Dreams. Dreams with destiny weaving its own pattern. Cruel and unpredictable. The baby was born in July of 1848, and it was a boy. It lived 3, maybe 4 months, and then its small heart stopped beating. This son had meant so much to John Fremont, and he was dead. Just as dead as were Fremont's military glories. But now Jesse Fremont took command. The trailblazer, the fire-eating adventurer, had taken more punishment than it was reasonable to ask a man to endure. A woman? Well, women were of stronger fiber. So reasoned Jessie. She'd recover, but John had to be given new courage. And she gave it to him in simple strength. Gold had been discovered in California. And now more than ever, that railroad must be built. Now California was entering its true destiny. John should lead his expedition once more across the Rockies and across the Sierra, surveying the path of the railroad. And she, Jessie, with her small daughter, would travel by sailing ship out of New York and across Panama. She would meet John in San Francisco, that wonderful San Francisco that was on the tongue of every man and woman in the world. San Francisco, where the streets were literally paved with gold. She'd meet him in San Francisco, and then he'd take her to that beautiful world of great trees he told her about, that land in the Santa Cruz Mountains, where she would make a home for her family. This was to be the beginning of a new life. Her eyes flashing, she told him this was the beginning of the story of the Fremont family. And bravely they started out, the one by land, the other by sea. But the expedition was a journey of disasters, of lost trails, of starvation, of death of the men of Fremont's company. And Jesse's voyage was fraught with disaster and hardship. For reaching Panama, they went up the Chagres River, tormented by flies and mosquitoes, suffering from fever, eating food that was filthy and unpalatable. And when she finally reached Panama on the west coast of the isthmus, there was no boat to take her to California. The wild, unruly, fever-ridden town of Panama was overrun with travelers waiting to reach California and the gold fields. Food was at a premium, sleeping quarters unavailable. There was no boat to travel up the west coast. All ships in San Francisco Bay had been deserted, their crews, skippers, and owners all on their way to the gold fields of the mother lode. And there, while she suffered in Panama, came word by men who had come from California of the disaster that had overcome John Fremont's expedition. They had been lost in the snows. Many had died. By this time, undoubtedly, the entire expedition, including her husband, were dead. And with that stiff jaw that had carried her through trial after trial, Jesse Benton Fremont waited until finally, one morning, the hysteria of excitement swept the streets and alleys of Panama. Two ships had put in. One, the Panama, coming around the Horn. The other, the California, had scraped together a crew in the harbor of San Francisco and come to the relief of the travelers. Jessie and her daughter found passage on the Panama, and up the coast they sailed. And at San Diego, word came to her that her husband was alive. It had been feared his leg would have to be amputated after his exposure to the snows of winter, but he had escaped that disaster and was even then riding overland to San Francisco, would reach San Francisco before her. And on June 4th in 1849, the Panama sailed through the Golden Gate and Jessie and her child were carried ashore through the surf in the arms of seamen. The city was all but deserted. 9/10 of the population had gone to the mines. But all the population that remained had gathered at the Montgomery Street waterfront. a wild, a maddening, excited, cheering crowd of nondescript men, but no John Fremont. Jesse had become friends with a Mrs. Gray on the Western journey, and so Mrs. Gray and her husband took her to the Parker House and a small room where she could rest in quiet. Rest in quiet. The Parker House stood next to the El Dorado Gambling Palace. Night and day, the uproar was endless, and rain poured incessantly. The street in front of the Parker House was a quagmire of mud, and in this friendless, chill world, Jesse again awaited her husband. 10 days of waiting passed. The streets of San Francisco, a bedlam of gold-mad men, were unsafe for a lone woman, and Jesse Benton Fremont stayed in her room. And on the 10th day, at dusk, she heard a gathering crowd shouting beneath her window, and one voice calling, "Your wife's inside the house, Colonel." And a moment later, her door burst open, and she was in her husband's arms, sobbing, her trials now forgotten, fever forgotten, hardship forgotten. And when the two had told their stories, stories paralleling each other in cruel disaster, then Jesse straightened her shoulders. "Now," she said, "I want you to take me to our land, the ranch you have bought for our family in the mountains of Santa Cruz." John Fremont turned red, red with rage and unhappiness, for here at the climax of their journeyings was the bitterest tragedy of all. He had given Tom Larkin of Monterey money to buy for him the acres in the Santa Cruz Mountains, but either by error or by fraud, Fremont did not know which, Larkin had failed him. And instead of buying the Utopia in the mountains of Santa Cruz, he had bought in their name a valueless, a useless tract of land high in the Sierra, a place where nothing would grow, a place where white men couldn't live, a place called Mariposa. And so the second chapter in the lives of John and Jesse Fremont was ended, and destiny laughed her heartiest and cruelest laugh. For a few thousand years, alchemy was very big on the scene. Its chief aim was to change lead into gold. Eventually, it decayed into the classic forerunner of all con games. The only gold that alchemy ever produced was that handed over by hopeful sponsors to the glib alchemists. But out of alchemy came something ultimately finer than gold. Alchemy laid the basis for the science of chemistry, which has produced rewards aplenty. In the field of vision, for instance, chemistry has contributed greatly to the preservation of good eyesight in the form of effective medications and in the form of corrective lenses. And here is another step forward. Now you can enjoy uniformly colored sunglasses made in your regular prescription, whatever your degree of correction. These Jekyll Davidson sunglasses are better to look at and to look through because they're like regular sunglasses. No telltale darker and lighter areas on the lenses. See them soon at Jekyll Davidson. Bank credit cards honored. Have been the guest of Jekyll Davidson Optical Company for the San Francisco story. The men and women of Jekyll Davidson hope that you have enjoyed today's program and that you will join us again next week at 9:05 when we shall conclude our story of one of the great builders of the West, John Charles Fremont. Many of these stories are to be found in Samuel Dixon's book, Tales of San Francisco, on sale at all bookstores. This is Bud Heide, speaking for the Jekyll Davidson Optical Company with offices throughout Northern California.
KNBR, AM and FM in San Francisco. A's baseball, a doubleheader from Detroit, beginning this morning at 10 minutes past 10 o'clock. Here at KNBR, the time is 9:30. The temperature in the city is 55 degrees.
In the wilderness of these modern days, prepare ye the way of the Lord.
Coming again, coming again, Jesus is coming again.
From our Voice of Prophecy studios in Los Angeles, California, this is Dave Olson to welcome you to this half hour of inspiration. You will hear the music of the King's Harold's Quartet, Del Delker, Morita Phillips, and Brad Braver.